You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Bob Shrum is generally regarded as the foremost Democratic campaign consultant of the past three decades. In his new book, No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner, he reveals how American politics is practiced at the highest levels, and the story he tells won't make some politicians very happy. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased it has brought Bob Shrum to my show today. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
Does this mean that you've retired? Will candidates want to hire you after they read this book?
No, I think retiring was kind of a precondition of writing the book. But one thing I would say, by the way, is I hope when people read the book, they get a sense that it's not stick figures, it's not the papier-mâché notions we have of politics that really obtains when you're inside. I wrote the book because I was born in a working-class family in western Pennsylvania, raised in Los Angeles, where my parents went looking for a better life, got a scholarship, got some scholarships, found college debate, ended up through a series of happy accidents, at least for me. Everybody else might not regard them as happy. The center of American politics. And I wanted people to get a sense of what it's really like.
What was your first political campaign?
Well, my first political campaign was 1972, but before that I worked for John Lindsay when he was mayor of New York. I was very young. I had actually never written a political speech before when I got hired as his speechwriter. And I tell the story of him in the book because I think that history hasn't done him much of a service. He was actually a very personally brave man who had a lot of integrity, a lot of commitment, a lot of principle. And you know, I tell the story of the prison riot that occurred in the city when a lot of people were recommending that he just go in with massive force. And he said, I'm just not going to do it. A lot of people are going to get killed. I'm going to go in there and talk to people.
And yet, New Yorkers really polarized New Yorkers. I remember once being in the subway train where the train was stuck between stations and some man suddenly screamed out, that blankety blank Lindsay, as though
right.
John Lindsay was in front of the train with his hand up.
I think America was polarized at that time. I mean, I think whether it was Richard Nixon who polarized people in the other direction, John Lindsay, anywhere you look, there was tremendous polarization in the country because the issues were so big and so fundamental.
Now, you were a political speechwriter and then became a consultant.
Right.
Do people often go from one to the other?
Not that often, and I never escaped speechwriting. I always ended up being sort of asked to write some major speeches, or at least edit them,
and there is a connection. In some cases, even coming up with themes for a campaign, consultants will do that, and that grows out of a speechwriting sensibility, a slogan creating sensibility, doesn't it?
Well, there's a big difference between the 30-minute or 20-minute speech and the 30-second ad or the 5-second slogan. But you're right. At bottom, this is about whether or not you can locate a big idea at the heart of a campaign.
And you mentioned that your first real campaign was 1972. You've
right.
been involved in almost every presidential campaign since then, but you've been a lot more successful in local races than in presidential campaigns.
Well, yeah. People say that I lost. Actually, I think candidates win, consultants lose. 8 presidential campaigns. And I guess I'll take responsibility for that as long as, no matter how significant or insignificant my role was, if I get credit for 1960 when I was a young volunteer for John Kennedy. In a serious way, I think Al Gore won. And I don't really think about this as something that's about me. I think it's about the country.
Well,
I wish Gore was president on 9/11. We had written an acceptance speech draft and rather casually thrown in a line about Iraq that said, I have a message for Saddam Hussein. We're going to get even tougher on you. It's time for you to go. And Al Gore just took it out, just struck it out. I think he is a person of great prudence and great toughness. And I think if he'd been president on 9/11, we would have had 200,000 troops in Afghanistan. We would have captured Osama bin Laden, but there never would have been a war in Iraq.
But sometimes you say he's also indiscreet, like claiming that global warming was even a more present danger than terrorism, when he should have said it was the other great danger.
Well, that's a piece of political advice I offer in the book, which is that the safer thing to say is to appear on the at least if you're going to appear on the cover of Vanity Fair and it says the greatest danger in the world or the greatest danger of our time, maybe in your own piece inside you'd say there are two great dangers. But that's the kind of political advice I don't think he cares about very much anymore.
But it does open politicians to real criticism. We've seen this again and again. Somebody has a little slip of the tongue or says something that somebody might take offense with, and the next thing you know, everybody's descending on it.
Well, we saw that in the Gore-Bush debate, where the Bush people managed to turn the debate and spin the debate into a discussion about Gore's supposed exaggerations, when Bush actually had bigger exaggerations in the debate, and then made it a question of style over substance that Gore had sighed. I'd rather have a president who sighed in a debate than someone who lied us into a war that cost 3,500 American lives.
Well, do you agree with those people who say that part of the problem is that the press winds up agreeing on a scenario, and so we wind up with these stick figures? George Bush, the kind of bumbling, likable guy. Al Gore, the policy wonk who claimed that he invented the internet and all of that stuff.
Yeah, I've seen it time and again. Al Gore never said he invented the internet. He said he introduced correctly the legislation that led to the commercialization of this system inside the Defense Department. He didn't say that he found Love Canal. He said he held one of the first hearings into Love Canal. But he got put in that niche. I saw this with John Kerry in the fall of 2003. He was totally written off. I mean, we had a very hard time even getting press coverage. We were so short on money that even after winning Iowa, we went to this, I tell a story in the book, we checked into this hotel in New Hampshire called the Taj Inn, very nice people who were running it, but it had no breakfast room. Basically, you got a cup of coffee out of a machine. And one morning, I hear pounding on my door. I open the door. The Secret Service has now arrived. John Kerry is standing there in chinos and a T-shirt saying, "Do you have any hot water?" And I said, "No, I don't know. Let's go check." I had no hot water. He had no hot water. And the hotel had no hot water for about 24 hours. So we campaigned through that day hoping our deodorant held.
We spoke to Al Gore the other day, and he complains about the whole horse race approach of political campaigning today. Well, you were on Meet the Press yesterday to talk about the 2008 presidential election. Of course, they asked you who the front runners were and all of that stuff. Do you think that we are just doing this much too early?
Oh, I suppose we are. When John Kennedy declared on January 3rd, 1960, people said that's amazingly early to announce for president. I just don't think it's going to change. I mean, the Gore critique is an interesting critique, but we're going to play the horse race because the press wants to cover the horse race. It does a disservice in some ways. I remember in the 1972 campaign, George McGovern gave one of the first major speeches a presidential candidate ever gave on the environment. It got covered in the New York Times and almost nowhere else, because people were just focused on the horse race. The one thing I did say yesterday that I believe very strongly is that we have to be careful about drawing large conclusions at this point about what's going to happen next year. People are going to go through, whoever becomes the nominee is going to go through the valley at some point. Clinton did, Kerry did, Bush did in 2000. You go through a very testing and difficult time. I don't know when that's going to come.
What about the debates? We were seeing both Democratic and Republican debates now 500 days or so before the election. Do they have any real impact? Or is this also an opportunity to do a lot of gotcha?
Well, we had actually debates this early 4 years ago, too. So they've really moved up. I think that the gotcha part of the debates is something that, for example, Barack Obama has wisely avoided. I heard him criticized last night in the post-debate commentary, saying he missed his opportunity to go after Hillary Clinton. Well, I write in the book that on January 1st, around January 1st, people in Iowa get up and they say, okay, now it's time to get serious. Who am I really for president? And the question about Obama that they're going to ask, is he serious and substantive enough to go with the excitement? If he just spends his time tearing down Hillary Clinton, she spends his time tearing down Barack Obama, John Edwards probably comes up the middle and gets nominated.
My guest is Robert Shrum. His book, No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner, published by Simon & Schuster. Well, it's interesting that you bring up Iowa, because yesterday the Washington Post reported that in its national poll, Hillary Clinton was leading the Democratic pack, and then Barack Obama was second, far behind. John Edwards even further behind. However, in Iowa, the first caucus state, the Des Moines Register said it was Edwards first, Obama second, Clinton third, and they're very close together. And Bill Richardson trailing with 10%. The others are all in the 20s. And you say that we should be paying a lot more attention to Iowa than to the national polls?
I think we should look at if you want to get some sense, and I want to say these polls are very changeable at this point, but as we get to the end of the year, we should be looking at the Iowa polls, the New Hampshire polls, the South Carolina polls. Howard Dean was doing very well in the Democratic national polls just before the Iowa caucuses. Shortly after the Iowa caucuses, he was doing very badly. So what happens is that Iowa and New Hampshire and those early primaries aren't just sequential, they're synergistic. And they kind of determine who gets onto the stage and who are the two finalists or three finalists that people pick among.
So should Hillary Clinton be concerned that she's trailing both Edwards and Barack Obama?
Yes, she should be concerned about it. And someone in her campaign wrote a memo, apparently, saying that maybe she should consider skipping Iowa. The problem with that, and I write about this too, is no one who has skipped Iowa, except in 1992 when Tom Harkin was running as a favorite son, has ended up as the nominee in either party for a long time. I think she wisely decided she was going to stay in Iowa and fight.
You said on Meet the Press yesterday, I don't think Giuliani can be the Republican nominee. There are many people probably on the Republican right and on the New York left who would be happy to hear that.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't be for Giuliani under any circumstances myself, but it's an analytic point to me. I think the Republican Party, no matter how much he talks about terror and security, the conservative base is not going to get over the proposition that he is pro-choice, that he is pro-gay. He went through a little period of waffling trying to get around it, and then I think he wisely decided, I can't get around my record, I'm going to stick with it.
But he came out very strongly for torture, so perhaps that will please some people. And you say Mitt Romney is all over the place.
Well, Mitt Romney is interesting. I was involved on the other side in the only campaigns I think that Giuliani and Romney have ever lost. I worked for Senator Kennedy when Romney was running against him in 1994, and in the debate he insisted very strongly that he was pro-choice, and Senator Kennedy responded that actually he was multiple choice. I think we're going to see that clip. And what he's done, I mean, in that debate he also said that he was more for gay rights than Ted Kennedy was. A few years ago he was moderate on immigration. And I think they've done such a huge makeover on him of such proportions that they've actually hurt him. He's like a zip drive into which you stick a different disc.
And McCain, who was the favorite of the press, never seems to make it with the Republican voters. Why is that?
I think
he votes the way I would think Republican voters mostly would want their candidate to vote.
Well, the conservative base, some of the activists in the base are mad at him because of campaign finance reform.
Which he's distancing himself from.
Some, yes. John McCain should have just stayed John McCain because he hasn't converted a lot of the people on who don't like him by trying to be someone else, and I don't think he's very comfortable with it. In the end, I still think he may be the Republican nominee. There was a Democratic boss here in New York named Ed Flynn in the 40s, and someone once went to him and complained about the candidate he was slating, and he looked at him and said, "Who else you got?" And I think John McCain may become the Republican nominee on the who else you got standard, which is why we're seeing the emergence of Fred Thompson right now.
Well,
I mean, you have a lot of
people. And everybody seems to like him in the Republican Party.
Yeah, and we don't know anything about how he's going to run as a candidate. I watch him, and I think that the comparison to Ronald Reagan is, I mean, I know Fred Thompson a little bit, and I like him. I disagree with him on a lot of things, but he's no Ronald Reagan.
I think I've heard something similar to that in a debate once, and you reveal that that was not an ad lib.
No, and a number of people had something to do with that. I mean, I had read Maureen Dowd's piece in which Dan Quayle kept defending his qualifications to be vice president by citing John Kennedy. And so when we got into the Benson debate prep, we started talking about it, and the lines got developed. I didn't develop them all by myself. And I had the germ of the idea. And the funny thing was that it's clear that the Quayle people, and if you go through the story in the book, it's funny, it's clear that the Quayle people had warned him not to say this. Because the first three times he got asked about his qualifications, he gave a different answer. And then Tom Brokaw, I think it was, said, not to beat this drum one more time, let me ask you about your qualifications. And he reached down into his rhetorical DNA, ignored the warnings, and said that he had exactly the same number of years of experience as John Kennedy. And when Lloyd Bentsen turned to him and said, look, I knew John Kennedy, I was a friend of John Kennedy's, you're no John Kennedy. I mean, it was devastating. And he made it, Quayle made it worse by saying, Senator, that was uncalled for. And Quayle quite spontaneously said, you're the one who made the comparison.
Robert Schrum's book, No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner, is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Robert Schrum. His book, No Excuses, Concessions. I want to say confessions, but concessions is important here.
I'm not confessing. I'm just being honest about what happened, and I'm honest about the mistakes I made, I hope.
The Schrum curse.
Well, I don't believe in the Schrum curse or the Schrum primary, actually. You know, it's sort of funny because I've done 10 overseas races for president or prime minister that have been successful. I just wish somehow or other I'd been able to bring it back home. I do think Al Gore won. I insist on that every time anybody says it.
Well, you won.
And by the way, John Kerry,
you won a lot of local races. Yeah,
well, a lot of Senate races, a lot of governor's races. But John Kerry came within an ace of being the first candidate ever to defeat an incumbent president renominated by his own party in time of war. But what we do in the Democratic Party, we did this to Al Gore, is if someone doesn't win or doesn't get inaugurated, we kind of hold a ritual beating up of them. In the Republican Party, they recycle their past candidates until they succeed.
In the case of John Kerry, there were all sorts of recriminations about the campaign, but most important, the Swift boat ad and his slow response to it.
Yeah, listen, let me take my responsibility for that. We had made the decision to take federal funding, which was hotly debated inside the campaign. It meant we had the same amount of money as Bush did for an 8-week campaign. We had to make last for 13 weeks. So we made the decision and then said, the implication of this is that we aren't going to be on the air on television in August. Bush may run $50, $60 million worth of ads against us. Other independent groups may run ads against us. We're just not going to be on the air. The first week, the polling, basically, we gained 2 points nationally during the first week the Swift boats were on, and in the battleground states, we held it about 6 or 7 points ahead. We should have ignored all that. We should have ignored the polls. We should have said it doesn't matter what we've done in terms of accepting federal funding. We have to go out and fight back against this right away. Now, there are a lot of different versions of this story. Let me tell you, the one person who was right about this all along was John Kerry, who wanted to respond from the very start.
Well, couldn't he have just called press conferences and said, I'm outraged, instead of having to spend money?
Well, we did. The first thing he did do, actually, was give a speech to the firefighters saying he was outraged. And the campaign did fight back in the free press. But it didn't matter until we went on the air and fought back with advertising. And we should have done it right away. Look, over the years, I got accused of being a master of negativity and a maestro of negative advertising. My instinct is not to sit there. And we weren't crazy. I mean, if we had seen this happening and seen the bad things happening in the polling right away, we would have reacted. But I'm not making excuses. I'll give you explanations. I'm not making excuses because I should have had the good sense, and so should the rest of us, to listen to the candidate's instinct right away.
In the case of Al Gore, all sorts of reasons have been given for his losing. One, Ralph Nader has been blamed. Another is he didn't invite Bill Clinton to campaign for him. Another is that he couldn't even win his own home state. Some others were that the images that were created around him were destructive. You say he won the election. He definitely won the popular vote. But and of course, others say, well, it's just stacked Supreme Court. Why didn't he?
Well, I'll give you one. The butterfly ballot alone would have changed the outcome of the election. I do not believe that thousands of Jewish retirees on the Gold Coast of Florida voted for Pat Buchanan for president. Neither does Pat. And that alone would have changed the outcome. I discuss at some length in the book why we didn't call on President Clinton to do more campaigning, which he wanted to do. His numbers were soft and undecided voters. His favorable unfavorables were not in very good shape. Senator Harkin from Iowa was a longtime client of mine, got me the weekend before the election and said, you got to send Clinton back here for a last visit. And we did not want to reveal these numbers or create any more tension with the White House than there was. And finally, I said, if you won't talk about him, I'll tell you, he's got a 37 favorable and a 49 unfavorable among soft and undecided voters. Among all voters, it's even worse among soft and undecided voters. Here's what the focus group research is saying. I went through it, and Harkin said to me, can you send Joe Lieberman back for one last visit? Now, I think it's a little different for Hillary Clinton now. For one thing, George W. Bush is the circuit breaker on whatever cognitive dissonance people had about Bill Clinton. They look back now and they see 20 million jobs, balanced budget, president who seemed very much on top of things. And I think that image has been repaired very substantially. If you listen to Bush throughout the 2000 campaign, his entire subtext was an attempt to run against Clinton. I'm going to restore honor and dignity to the Oval Office. So we had to deal with that problem. We weren't crazy. And look, no one out of pique would have thrown the presidency away. I like Bill Clinton. And in fact, Al Gore would have been happy to have Bill Clinton campaign everywhere if it would have helped him become president.
You were there during the worst days of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, weren't you?
Well, I was there at the beginning. And in that first week when it broke and we were getting ready for the State of the Union message. And I never saw anyone more disciplined than Bill Clinton was. I mean, he knew that the speech he was going to give in a week could have a lot to do with determining whether people thought he was still up to the job of being president. He worked on that speech very, very hard. He understood he had to get Democrats to their feet at the very beginning, which is why he talked about saving Social Security first, why we put the minimum wage near the top of the speech. But he did a superb job on that speech. Then, as he was leaving the White House to go up to Capitol Hill, Hillary Clinton had asked me to talk to him because I had to go down to North Carolina. I was working for a young unknown running for the Senate in a long shot bid named John Edwards, and I had to get down to North Carolina for a meeting, and I had to take the last plane. So she asked me to talk with him as he was leaving the White House, and he said to me, do you think this will work? And I said, yes, I think it's going to work.
First of all, let me tell everybody that Robert Shrum is my guest. His book, No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner, is published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. You were going down to campaign for a young man named John Edwards. Do you and John Edwards speak anymore?
I haven't talked to him in the last 3.5 years. It's not.
But you were friendly with Elizabeth, weren't you?
Oh, sure. I was friendly with both of them, and my wife and I were both friendly with both of them. And by the way, people have cherry-picked the book about what I say about John Edwards. Couple of things that I'd like to say very, very plainly. When I first met him, I called my partners and said, I think I just met someone who may be a future president of the United States. I think he's done a lot to put poverty. In fact, he more single-handedly has put poverty back on the national agenda, at least the Democratic Party agenda. He has a really ambitious health care plan. I comment in the book that I didn't think he was ready to be president in 2004, a judgment which, by the way, I believe was shared by the primary voters.
You say cherry-picked. Both Time magazine and especially the Washington Post have really just zoned in on the John Edwards part of this book.
Well, and certain parts of the John Edwards part of the book, but that's the nature of, you know, that goes back to your question about Al Gore and how things get reported. I mean, am I surprised by that? No. Is there a fuller picture of John Edwards? I hope in this book, yes.
You also admit to being one of the advisors who suggested to him that it would be politically expedient to vote for the war. He had misgivings about voting that way?
I'm no national security expert. And when I was asked, by the way, the national security experts almost to a person were wrong in terms of their recommendation, which was to vote for it, in my view.
There's a big article in the Sunday Times magazine about what led Hillary Clinton to vote the way that she did, and they go in great detail into all of the debate within the campaign. But she even made more of a commitment than John Edwards did.
Yeah, I'm a little stunned by the reaction or the overreaction to the idea that any of these folks would ask about the political implications of the vote. Of course they did. Almost everybody did. It's a kind of Casablanca notion of politics to be shocked that politics is going on here. I regret that I agreed with the advice and said to John Edwards that I thought he didn't have enough background experience in national security to vote against this war. But I don't think that he decided that the war was wrong and then voted for it for political reasons. I don't think anybody did that. I don't think John Kerry did that. I think they knew what the political pressures were. They felt the political pressures. And it tends to reshape the lens through which you view and weigh the merits. It's almost a subconscious or unconscious process.
But perhaps more damaging is the section of your book that the Washington Post selected that dealt with his Senate campaign in 1998, where you asked him, what's your position on gay rights? And you said that he replied, I'm not comfortable around those people.
Right.
And there are other people who say they were in the room who didn't hear it that way.
Well, what they say is that that it's out of context. I don't know exactly what that means.
Whenever a politician says they took me out of context, I say, well, what does that mean? I want to read the whole speech and see if you actually said, I'll kill that guy.
Yeah. There's no question that he said it. And the book goes on to explain, and by the way, he himself has explained that the background he came from made it hard for him to deal with this issue. And I say that he clearly moved and evolved on it. And I think that's a genuine evolution. I think it also reflects the necessity of politics in the Democratic Party. But I have no doubt that he said it.
In the Washington Post, John Edwards spokesman Eric Schultz says, Shrum has a very casual relationship with the truth. Bob is obviously more interested in selling books than reporting honestly and accurately about what happened.
I don't know what that means, and I'm not going to respond at that kind of personal level. What I was really talking about was the evolution of John Edwards on this issue. I think he did evolve on the issue, and I think saying it was out of context or coming up with some convoluted explanation of why he said this actually doesn't make it better.
In your book, you offer the Democrats some advice for 2008. If Democrats are afraid to say what we are about, if the party doesn't stand for something more than a set of poll-tested programs and a carefully engineered set of tactics to win office, we are likely to lose unless the Republicans hand us victory on a platter of indisputable failure or perceived economic crisis.
They may do that, actually.
Well, it's going to be very difficult for the Republicans because there's so much anger toward George Bush at this moment. But doesn't that go against everything that you and all the other political consultants have been doing all these years?
No, it's what I've always believed. The other attack on me that I heard a lot of and that led me to another mistake I made over the time I was in the business was that I'm too populist, too liberal, believe too strongly in some of what I regard as fundamental democratic values. I think Al Gore is authentically, as my partner in that enterprise and his old friend Carter Eskew said, a futurist populist. And I think it was a mistake to take the populist edge off as we moved into the general election when he had spoken about the people, not the powerful, had given an acceptance speech that basically had turned the campaign around by about somewhere between 15 and 18 points. I think we should have stayed there. And I didn't fight the way I should have fought on that, partly because I knew people were just going to say, there he goes again, the same old populist stuff. But I believe if the Democratic Party doesn't stand for economic and social justice, if we're just a party of convenience, if we're standing there in case the Republicans fail, we might win some elections, but we won't change the country in ways that really matter, and we won't build an enduring Democratic consensus. We are still living off the memory of a president who has now been dead for almost 44 years.
A listener writes in accusing you of giving poor advice to Hillary Clinton to have scripted spontaneity. He says that's just the sort of thing that...
I have no idea what he's talking about.
Well, he says did you advise her to nothing of that sort?
No.
Well, now we know what the Internet is all about. I hadn't heard of it, but I trust my listeners.
She hasn't asked me for advice. I'm not advising anybody in this campaign.
What is your feeling about Howard Dean's leadership of the DNC?
I think the 50-state strategy makes some real sense at a senatorial and congressional level. We can win a Senate seat in Montana. I think the notion that we're going to have a 50-state strategy in a presidential election, as long as we have the Electoral College, is far-fetched.
You mean you should still just write off some states?
Well, we're not going to carry Idaho or Utah. It doesn't matter what we do. And I don't frankly think the Republicans are going to carry, say, Massachusetts, pretty much no matter what they do.
Even though a state like Utah will wind up electing a Democratic governor?
For generations, the state of Montana elected Mike Mansfield to the United States Senate, and he was the Democratic majority leader of the Senate. Almost never voted Democratic in a presidential campaign.
Forgive me for asking such an obvious question, but if you could just pick a dream candidate for the Democrats right now, the one who you think will, doesn't matter what's going to happen during this primary campaign, but who you think would have the strongest chance, who would you pick?
Well, I can't because I have my one other thing I do besides teaching at NYU at the Wagner School is I'm a political analyst for MSNBC and I get paid, so I can't be for anybody. I can be for the Democratic nominee, but I can't be for any of these candidates.
So that's what you're doing now? You're working as a political commentator?
Well, no. My principal job is as a senior fellow at the Robert F. Wagner School at New York University. I'm teaching graduate students. I also teach a freshman honors seminar, and I do some commentary for Hardball on MSNBC.
And I'm very grateful that you came by to talk about politics today on our show. Robert Shrum, S-H-R-U-M, in case you didn't know, his book No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner. It is published by Simon & Schuster. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.